It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, opiate abuse is on the rise in Wisconsin and around the country. We'll talk to a reporter about how this problem is affecting the Oneida community here in Wisconsin.
First, Governor Scott Walker signed 46 bills into law yesterday at the state capitol. One of the bills signed was a controversial measure that bans county executives from serving on the state legislature.
Jesse Appoyan is with us to talk about the bills that are now law. She's a state government reporter at the Capital Times. Jesse, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back on.
Well, sometimes when legislation is signed into law, there's a big ceremony. It's at a factory or some public site. This was a private ceremony, kind of cranking a lot of them out. Does this mean that there wasn't like high profile sales pitch type stuff here?
There was 46 bills yesterday, and we know actually now because the governor just tweeted a photo of his hand that he's signed 58 more bills today. So it's a packed couple of days getting those bills signed into law.
And there's not really a common theme. This is et cetera, miscellaneous potpourri type legislation, a little bit of everything.
Yeah, definitely. It runs the gamut.
Well, we mentioned that county executive and state legislature, state senate one. It says county executives can't serve in the legislature while they're serving as a county executive. This had one very specific use in mind, didn't it?
It did. It was a very specific use, and the author was Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, and he made no secret of the source of that bill. He said when Winnebago County Executive Mark Harris launched his candidacy for an open Senate seat, he started thinking about the implications of that. So Mark Harris is a Democrat. He's running for the seat that will be vacated by Rick Gudex, who's a Republican, and he's been Winnebago County Executive for about 10 years. Senator Fitzgerald said he was concerned about the fact that, you know, you could have potentially someone serving in these two positions drawing some pretty lucrative salaries funded by taxpayer dollars, and he wanted to put a stop to that.
So Harris could still run for this office, but if he wins in the Senate, he can't keep that county executive seat. We use the word controversial. How did Democrats respond to this legislation?
Yeah, Democrats were not thrilled, and there are actually a handful of Republicans who voted against it as well. And they just said, you know, this is a cheap shot. This is going after one person. They noted people have for short times held the two positions in the past, and I think the idea here was that if Mark Harris were to win, he had suggested that he would stay on for as long as his county executive term would last and not necessarily seek that position again. And some Democrats said, you know, he should be able to do that.
Staying on the theme of fairly specific legislation, towns in one county, Dane County, can now opt out of county zoning laws. So what was the source for that? What was the reasoning to pass that?
That was a few members of the Dane County Towns Association. So they were kind of, the towns were split on this, but a few of the towns in that association said this will offer them more autonomy at the local level, at the town level, to build and grow their tax bases. Those who were against it said this is just going to make it, you know, way too fragmented when it comes to the decisions being made within the county, and could throw off the balance of development within the county. So this bill is not specifically set to apply only to Dane County, but because of the threshold on population that's set in the bill, that is the only county that it would apply to.
Is that unusual to have something that finely tuned that in effect? I guess sometimes with bigger city stuff, you think of something that might apply only to Milwaukee City or Milwaukee County.
Sure, yeah, and you'll find that fairly frequently, things that are maybe only going to apply to Milwaukee County or the city of Milwaukee. And in this case, Milwaukee County is big enough for this to apply. It just doesn't have any towns within it.
Talking to Jesse Appoyan from the Capital Times about 40-some pieces of legislation signed into law yesterday, another 50-plus signed in today as Governor Walker catches up with a flurry of late legislative action. This one got some attention. Libraries can now report borrowers who owe money to collection agencies or to law enforcement. So you've got overdue books. I guess libraries can now report you to a collections agency. Was this already happening? Is this something that's new, or is this just kind of clarifying existing practice?
Yeah, so this is they're not going after people who've had a book overdue for a week or so. This is more serious, things that are costing actual money on books being out. So we're talking, you know, a fine of more than $50. They can turn them over to law enforcement. So this is kind of just clarifying two sort of existing parts of law and saying here's how this should work. So yes, libraries have contracted with collection agencies in the past or have worked with law enforcement before, but this says everyone can do it. There's no question about the ability to do that.
Now, there are a couple of water-related bills signed into law. What kind of things did we see there?
Yeah, we've seen a couple bills working their way through the legislature that relate to shoreland zoning. And so this particular bill that was signed yesterday is a companion to another one, and those together would work to set some different standards for siting structures along shores of lakes and rivers throughout the state. They were touted as a property rights package that would allow homeowners and property owners to have a little more control over the structures that are on their properties. Counties would not be able to block those property owners from, you know, building, say, a certain distance from water through their zoning ordinances. And so that one had some concerns among the environmental community, but was also pitched as something that would help property owners. The other bill that we saw related to water dealt with high-capacity wells, and that's another one where there's actually multiple high-capacity wells working their way through the legislative process as well. So this one is slightly less controversial, I believe, than the other one. This one just says any well that's mostly used for fire protection or to provide water to a family residence located on the same property is not classified as a high-capacity well and isn't subjected to some of the potential DNR fees that would be associated with that.
One theme that critics of Republicans have raised is, in reference to that first, that shoreline development legislation you mentioned, is overriding local control. And people have been trying to tally up a series of bills saying, hey, all these measures are examples of the state government overriding local control. Is that an argument you're hearing a lot?
Yeah, that's definitely been one we've been hearing, especially as the session comes to a close. I don't remember what the final tally was, but it was high on this memo that Democrats had put together on how many proposals actually curb local control. And the Republican response to that is they still believe that they're the party of local control, but in some cases it just makes sense for the state to have a set of uniform standards.
And speaking of uniform regulations, there is a law on sex offenders and restrictions on where they can and can't live. What changed there?
Yeah, and that, that again, just gives statewide regulations. So that'll deal with where violent sex offenders can live. That makes it so that a municipality or a local community can't have different zones and different ordinances than the rest of the state.
So that's a lot of legislation. You mentioned more than 50 more signed today. What else was on the table that people were keeping an eye on?
So we don't know what ended up getting signed today, but there's more bills dealing with shoreland zoning, more I'm drawing a blank here. Bills dealing with that, a couple more in that sort of property rights area, and that's what we're going to find out, I guess, what the governor puts out when he lets us know at the end of the day what was involved in that 58-bill package.
100 pieces of legislation, all told, Jesse. You're not intimately familiar with each and every one of them or where they are right now.
It's a little hard to keep
me
track.
Neither.
And now we're moving on to the ones that are going to be coming to the Senate for final approval. So
I'm in the same boat. Yeah,
so motion.
The Assembly is done, so nothing else will come from there. But the Senate is not done. There might be some things still hanging on that they may send to the governor, so we'll be watching for that, right?
Yep, there's still a little motion happening within the next 2 weeks.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Jesse, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
That's Jesse Apoyan, state government reporter for the Capital Times.
Coming up, we'll talk to a reporter from an Oneida newspaper about how the rise of opiate abuse is affecting the community here in Wisconsin.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we talk about the rise of chaplains in the workplace and find out why businesses are bringing spiritual leaders into the office.
First, opioid abuse is on the rise in Wisconsin and in the country as a whole. Opioids are highly addictive and include any drug with morphine-like effects, including prescription painkillers, things like OxyContin, and illegal drugs like heroin.
Users typically become addicted to prescription painkillers first and then move to heroin use since heroin is less expensive and easier to get than prescription painkillers. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported a threefold increase in prescription opiate overdose deaths and a fivefold increase in heroin overdose deaths since the year 2000. The Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office says that in just Milwaukee County, there's been a 600% increase in heroin overdose deaths in the last 10 years.
Another part of the state affected by increasing opiate abuse is the Oneida Nation. A new two-part series in the official newspaper of the Oneida Tribe of Indians of Wisconsin takes a look at the rise of opiate abuse.
Christopher Johnson wrote that series, and he's with us now to talk about it. He's a reporter and photographer for the Oneida newspaper, Gully Wesox. Christopher, thanks for joining us.
You bet. Thank you very much, Veronica.
So, Christopher, for the first part of your series, you talked with a counselor for Oneida's Behavioral Health Department. What did she share with you about what she's seeing in her work there?
Well, she goes into work on a daily basis, and this isn't just her. This is probably all 12 of the counselors that work for the tribe's behavioral health department. She arrives into work, and she has a full slate on a daily basis, and she's seeing what is typical, the largest percentage of abuse of drug of choice being alcohol, at a 60% of her caseload. But 20% comprises opiate abuse. So she has definitely noticed the upward trend in opiate pain pill abuse.
Is there any sort of pattern about who is abusing opiates at this point?
She didn't have any real breakdowns as far as names, or not names, but as far as like age groups or anything of that to that extent. It's pretty much a societal issue that we're seeing here because we're so close to the city of Green Bay that a lot of the problems do overlap both municipalities. But she is seeing a steady increase, as are the other counselors.
And what does opiate addiction look like on the Oneida Reservation? Any different than it might anywhere else in the country?
Well, they're noticing an increase in that. Over the years, like I mentioned before, alcohol will probably always be the larger issue here. Marijuana abuse will always remain pretty high as well. But they have noticed since about 2005, 2006, when heroin began to become a problem in the Brown County area, Green Bay in particular, there was a lot of overlap in the two municipalities, and there has been a steady increase.
What kind of treatment options are available for the Oneida community on reservations?
Well, fortunately, we've been one of the more lucrative, financially, fiscally tribes in the state of Wisconsin. So we actually have the proactive ability and the means to provide services to our tribal membership if an individual does feel that they're having issues or addiction or substance abuse issues. They can certainly approach the behavioral health department for treatment.
And what kind of warning signs are there that a loved one, a friend, might be abusing their prescriptions?
Well, a lot of the symptoms do mimic other forms of substance abuse issues. You'll see irritability. You'll see people lack of sleep, things of that nature, where they're just not able to function as a normal person would.
Now, you said that people on the reservation seeing an increase. Is this a new problem, or is this one that's just now just sort of starting to spike maybe?
They're beginning to see the increases, I would say, over the past 10 years. The Behavioral Health Department itself has noticed that increase as well. Unfortunately, they don't have solid numbers, blanket numbers over the years because they didn't have the means or the ability to track it at that time. There is a system being implemented at this point right now where they are attempting to actually break everything down and get numbers. But on an individual basis, the counselors are noticing that upward trend.
Is opiate addiction treated differently on the reservation than it might be with, say, marijuana or you mentioned alcohol abuse? How is it handled?
To my knowledge, it's actually handled pretty much the same as it would in any other community. Again, there's no real racial delineating line that separates one racial group from another as far as how they are treated. It's treated pretty much the same way as it would in any other community.
In terms of the treatment that we're talking about, are there enough resources to go around? Is the help available? Or with the increase in cases, is it getting harder to be seen and be helped?
Fortunately, like I mentioned before, Oneida itself, being one of the larger tribes in the state of Wisconsin, we do have the fiscal ability to treat our membership with the increase of gaming funding that we've had in the past 20 years. We've been able to proactively, instead of just punitively, deal with issues or addiction issues. So people do have that option and that ability out there. Unfortunately, people going through some type of substance abuse issue don't often always just proactively go and seek help. They usually end up having to wait until there's some type of life crisis or that they're experiencing so much pain that they're forced into some type of treatment facility. So the help is there. It's definitely there for employees of the tribe as well. We do have an employee assistance program that's also proactively helping employees that may be suffering from addiction issues.
Now, in this series of years, you're focusing on the Oneida tribe. Do you have a sense about whether this is being mirrored in other tribes across the state?
Like I mentioned before, the Oneida, we are pretty fortunate that we have the ability to deal with these issues. I can't actively speak about other tribes, the other 10 tribes in Wisconsin. From a law enforcement perspective, I do know that they formed a Native American drug gang initiative back in 2007, which is multi-jurisdictional, which encompasses all tribes in the state of Wisconsin. So from a law enforcement perspective, they're actively actually working together to combat issues with gangs, with the influx of drugs, things of that nature.
We're talking with Christopher Johnson right now. He wrote a series for the Oneida newspaper, Galiwisox, looking at opiate abuse among the Oneida tribe. And you talked a little bit there about the Native American Drug and Gang Initiative and how they're working cooperatively. How has that changed things?
Well, it has actually helped quite a bit. There have been a number of cases where individuals may be wanted for specific issues, such as gang issues or drug issues, where this person may be wanted for something, and in the past that person could actually move from one reservation to another reservation in the hopes of evading arrest. And now with the Native American Drug and Gang Initiative, NADGI as it's called, they're actually federally mandated and able to actually cross jurisdictions and work cooperatively on different reservations to help stem this problem.
What does that do for keeping track of what's happening in terms of seizures and also other aspects of this problem?
Well, that's a very good question. Prior to 2007, actually probably 2010 or 2011, law enforcement didn't always have the ability to break down and write those numbers down, actually have solid numbers. But based upon what I've able to gather since 2011, I came across some very interesting statistics that showed pain pill arrests as well as drug marijuana seizures actually dropped. But with the NADGI task force, they've actually had a number of increases in various drugs. Heroin arrests, for instance, jumped by 100%. Cocaine jumped by 110%. And methamphetamines skyrocketed by 269% from 2012 to 2015.
So looking at this reporting then, Do you have an idea about whether what we're looking at here is really represents a true increase in opiate abuse or whether you're just getting a better handle on the real numbers?
At this point, what I was able to gather from behavioral health, they're actually seeing a steady increase in the number of people that are actually coming in for treatment, whether those people are proactively seeking it or if they're being forced into treatment, that we don't know. However, the law enforcement numbers suggest a drop. That isn't necessarily the case because there is so much overlapping between the communities of Green Bay and Oneida. There's so much interaction between the two communities that their law enforcement, NADGI task force in particular, are pretty convinced that the problem is increasing.
And what did you come across as to why that might be?
Well, the increase in gang activity with not just the Oneida Reservation, but in the Green Bay and northeast Wisconsin as well, plays a big role in that. There's a lot of, we're on a major highway, 43 north and 41 north from the larger cities, they call them source cities of Milwaukee and Chicago, that also source through Madison up to Green Bay. So that's a big part of the problem right there, are gangs that are actually sending and bringing these drugs up to the area.
And you have a section of your piece that looks specifically at Native American gangs. What role do they play, and are they usually standalones, or are they affiliated with other groups?
A lot of them are affiliated with other groups. The NADGI task force did take down a gang about 2 or 3 years ago, but there are gangs that are specifically geared as Native American. And those gangs obviously have the ability to move in and out of the communities with much greater ease than, say, an outsider would. So it certainly causes a problem. problem for law enforcement. Again, the chief of police wanted to be very clear that we're not being overrun by drug gangs and we're not being overrun by gangsters and things like that. But it is a problem and it is increasing, and we wanted to increase community awareness of the situation.
And it sounds like with this cooperation going on in the past, someone from one of these Native American gangs or a gang working in the area might be able to flee to, say, another reservation. It sounds like that's maybe being curtailed.
That is absolutely what is happening. I did speak with a Najee Task Force commander who is in charge of the unit, and he told me that that was their number one goal and initiative, was to actually make it next to impossible for members to flee to other communities if they're being involved in some type of criminal activity, such as robbery, drugs, gangs, that sort of thing. So the issue is being looked at very closely, and it is being dealt with very proactively.
Christopher, we'll leave it there. Thank you.
All right, Veronica, thank you very much for having me.
That's Christopher Johnson, reporter and photographer for the Oneida newspaper, Gully Wee Sox. He was with us to talk about his two-part series on the rise of opiate abuse in the Oneida community.
Coming up, we talk to our guests about workforce chaplain programs, why more and more businesses are allowing spiritual leaders in the workplace, and what it means for workers. And by the way, thank you to everyone who contributed during the winter membership drive. More than 3,700 listeners pledged, including 865 new members to Wisconsin Public Radio, donated more than $500,000 to fund the WPR programs you count on. Thank you so much. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Workplace culture is always changing, and lately there are a lot of conversations about creating holistic work environments. Things like yoga and meditation rooms are gaining popularity in the business world, but what about bringing spiritual advisors, counselors into your workplace?
Lately, more and more businesses and corporations are bringing chaplains onto staff or into the workplace. Some employers say it allows employees to bring their whole selves to work and maybe increases productivity.
Here to tell us more about workplace chaplain programs, we have Steve Cook, owner and founding chaplain at Capital Chaplains, an organization based in Middleton that provides chaplaincy services to companies in the Capital region of South Central Wisconsin. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob and Veronica, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, when a lot of people think of, when I think of chaplains, I'll think of, a hospital, prison, Father Mulcahy on MASH. How about corporate settings? How do chaplains fit in at a work site?
Well, actually, it's very similar to those other traditional forms of chaplaincy, but the people that we serve are company owners, managers, and employees. So it's providing care, but in the workplace, not in the military or the hospital setting.
And again, in that military, hospital, prison setting, I think a very stressful environment, maybe tragedy or, a difficult situation of one sort or another. What kind of concerns do chaplains at workplaces find themselves talking about?
Sure. Other forms of chaplaincy are in crisis mode most of the time. That's by definition why they're there. Workplace chaplains, we're in first responder or crisis mode about 5 to 10% of the time. So the majority of the time is spent coming alongside employees, owners, and managers in the everyday stuff of life. So it's providing care with the everyday burdens, not always a crisis. It's not always a negative or a challenge. Sometimes it can be something to celebrate and something to rejoice as well.
And I've seen these chaplain assistance programs, I think they're called sometimes, compared to employee assistance programs, where a company might have the sign that says, hey, if you need help with the stress in your life or something, call the company's 800 number or something like that. What are the advantages of having a chaplain on site to something like that?
Yeah, great question, Rob. We get asked it quite often. So an EAP or an employee assistance program is set up to provide care for employees and their household or family members. In the Madison community, typically a good EAP would have a response rate of about 6 to 7%. That's actually very good. Our own Capital Chaplain statistics show that 65 to 90% of the employees of our client companies receive care by the chaplains in a given year. And that's really two reasons. One is it's relational in nature, so our chaplains are on site every week developing relationships with the employees or their family or household members. And then it's proactive, so we can catch things early on as opposed to waiting until something, a problem is full-blown and the pain level is through the roof before somebody's motivated to call an 800 number or go to a website. So it's an extension of an EAP or an employee assistance program. The CEO of a company of about 500 employees described it as an EAP on steroids.
You know, one maybe obvious stumbling block people might think of is there are a lot of different religions, different spiritualities in the world. The chaplain, him or herself, will be from one of those. But how do they work with people of, say, if they're a Protestant Christian, somebody from a different denomination or a Catholic or somebody who's Jewish or Muslim or atheist? How do they cross those boundaries to help people out?
Sure. Another great question, Rob. So chaplains are trained to help people of all faiths or no faith. Okay, we provide in many cases, in fact, probably 90% of the time, we provide what we term just generic human care. We show up. If somebody's in jail or they're in an emergency room someplace or there's been a family conflict, they just appreciate human assistance. Their values don't particularly come into play at that moment. So most people, when the chips are down, just appreciate another human being coming alongside and providing real care. Now, for those about 10% of the people, of employees that ask for spiritual guidance, if it's within our faith tradition as a particular chaplain, then we can provide care. We are trained very effectively that if it's outside of our particular faith tradition, then our job as a chaplain is to refer them to somebody who can help them. So it works very well, and the effectiveness is very good when everybody follows those guidelines.
We're talking to Steve Cook about workforce chaplain programs. He's the owner and founding chaplain at Capital Chaplains of Middleton. Now we'll hear about a particular chaplain program, one at Tyson Foods, which experts say is the largest known publicly traded company that has a corporate chaplaincy program. Joining us now is Mike Tarvin. He's director of chaplain services for Tyson Foods. He leads over 90 workplace chaplains employed by that company. He previously served as a chaplain with the U.S. Army. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Rob and Veronica. I appreciate being on the show.
Well, Mike, walk us through how the chaplain program works at Tyson Foods. Why does the company provide this? How is it supposed to help employees there?
Well, you know, and Steve gave some great background, fantastic answers about chaplaincy. Tyson Foods, similar intent. Our employees, we call them team members, and our chairman at a point in time about 2001 decided that that would be a great benefit to offer our team members to provide the same kind of services that Steve just talked about, making sure that you know, team members can bring their whole selves to work. That was a big thing that John Tyson wanted to provide, that you didn't have to check your faith at the door of the plant or the company, that you could bring your entire being to work.
And how did employees respond that when that was brought on board? How do they respond now? Have people really appreciated having this kind of access to a chaplain at the work site?
Yeah, it's really grown, Rob, since those first days. We started with just a few chaplains, and like you said at the beginning of this part, we have over 90 chaplains now, and it's really embraced by the operations management part, and the team members respond well. You know, Steve talked about, you know, the percentages, and we're right in that same ballpark in terms of a large percentage of our team members take advantage of the chaplains.
On a practical level, how does this work? If I'm working at a Tyson plant, can I schedule a chaplain break on my shift, or do I schedule something for after my shift? How does that work?
Well, yeah, generally speaking, we try to meet with our team members during maybe their lunch break or dinner break or right after one of their shifts. Sometimes in an emergency situation, the supervisor will actually say, hey, why don't you go talk to the chaplain and see if maybe they can help you? But primarily, our team members are there to work and make a living and produce a product, and so we try to work in the midst of that.
I think sometimes there's a sense of discomfort about religion in a workplace or other public places, for that matter, where people don't want to bring up that religious side of their life, worried about controversy, conflict with people of different beliefs or no beliefs. Do you see a pretty solid comfort level, though?
You know, I do. There's always, I think, you know, they say, what are the things you don't talk about, religion and politics?
Right.
But people have grown pretty comfortable with it and trust our chaplains to be good on both sides of the fence, our team members as well as management side of the house.
Now, I could see somebody wanting to do something like this and saying, let's bring in social workers or psychotherapists or counselors of some sort. Why is having that spiritual sphere an important part of the equation?
So it is unique, and I know you and Steve were talking about the EAP side of the house. I think chaplains just have there's some common values, I think, that everybody has, respect, dignity, compassion, kindness, that they would like to see in the workplace. And I think chaplains, more than anybody else, are people who can kind of purvey those things and be advocates for employees and companies to make sure that happens.
And Mike, I got to ask before we let you go, you were a chaplain, we mentioned, in the U.S. Army. How do you compare and contrast being a chaplain in a military setting versus a corporate setting?
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities in terms of, again, kind of going back to what Steve said. So a lot of the military stuff is semi-crisis, but really you're just there to care for people. And so regardless of the setting, that's what the chaplains do. So I find personally that the great crossover, and it's been a great transition for me from Army life to corporate life and ministering to people.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Mike Tarvin, Director of Chaplain Services for Tyson Foods. Steve Cook with Capital Chaplains. I want to throw this back to you. Hearing Mike talk about what they do there at Tyson, is this a pretty common, I mean, this is a big company. This is a pretty common example, though, of how businesses are using chaplains?
Absolutely. I think what you see in John Tyson, who was the original vision caster and pioneering leader to start this, and keep in mind, Tyson is a large publicly traded company. You know, you heard Mike say 110 some employees or team members, a lot of regulation, and yet they figured out how to implement an in-house corporate chaplaincy program to benefit their employees. And my understanding is that the individual plant managers that have profit and loss responsibilities make the decision as to whether or not that plant is going to have a chaplain program. So this is supported by corporate, but it's the decision is made by the individual plant manager whose, you know, neck is on the line as to whether or not the plant performs. But coming back to the commonality, clearly our clients are not as large as Tyson Foods, but the place of commonality is that the senior leaders want to lead their companies holistically. So they don't just care about the employees and what they can bring to the company, you know, the value that they can bring, but they desire to serve those employees in a holistic way. And that includes allowing employees to be themselves at work. So in Tyson's case, creating a faith-friendly environment, which is wonderful. And that's, I think, a pioneering form of leadership that we're seeing more and more throughout this country. It's wonderful to see.
We're talking about faith and spiritual advice at the workplace, specifically chaplain programs at what appears to be a growing number of American businesses. We have Steve Cook of Capital Chaplains based in Middleton with us.
And we want to know what you think. Should chaplains be brought into the workplace? Do you work somewhere where there are chaplains on staff? Tell us about your experience at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Again, that's 800-642-1234.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Steve Cook, owner and founding chaplain at Capital Chaplains, an organization based in Middleton, Wisconsin, that provides chaplain services to companies in the area.
And we want to know what you think about this idea of chaplains in the workplace. Do you work somewhere or have you worked somewhere with a chaplain on staff or a visiting chaplain? Did it help? Hurt in some way, or just didn't seem to make much difference? Tell us what you think about having this sort of spiritual advice, a chaplain in the workplace, or call in with your questions about how this works. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller now, John in Lake Halley. John, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Hey, what did you want to bring up, John?
Well, the fact that I am not religious, and what about the other religions that might not feel comfortable having only one religion actually portrayed at their workplace. I would feel uncomfortable working at a place where I had to pay lip service to a false god.
John, thanks a lot for the call. We sort of touched on this, but a little different wrinkle there, Steve. You said chaplains are trained to work with people of different faiths, but for people of a different faith or no faith, the fact that that chaplain is with a particular denomination or religion might seem like a message. Like, that's the way we're going as a company.
Yeah, John, a very good question. And again, most of the work that we do is in the broad human care category. So faith does not become part of the equation. We show up and we provide care. Again, as chaplains, we are trained to respect people and to respect their beliefs. So if it happens, if we're talking with somebody from another faith, that's fine. And we can affirm them and we can encourage them. Again, our job as chaplains in the faith arena is to provide assistance to that person, regardless of their faith background or no faith background, and get them the help that they need. So In practical terms, it really does work very well. When permission is extended, when an environment is created, where there's an openness to communicate about the real things of life.
John, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Can you talk, Steve, about, I guess, the right way to introduce this concept to a new work site, bring in that first chaplain and let the staff know what's going on here?
Sure. So typically, because chaplaincy, workplace chaplaincy is still relatively new, it traditionally is started, initiated by a senior leader that makes a leadership decision. We then typically communicate the program or the benefit to all the employees in either a large gathering or small groups. We have a time where we give the overview, features, and benefits of the program, talk about how it's going to work, the mechanics. Then we have a time of question and answer. And then we simply say, in the very near future, the chaplain or chaplains will be on site. Feel free to engage them if you'd like, or not. Again, the program is voluntary, paid for by the company. And sometimes we've had people that have engaged chaplains at the very conclusion of that first employee meeting. They've got something they want to talk to a chaplain, and they feel that either she or he can provide assistance for whatever they are carrying, whatever they're going through.
Talking about chaplains at the workplace with Steve Cook, owner and founding chaplain at Capital Chaplains. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been in a place where there is a chaplain to work with, at a hospital, prison, in the military, or, as we're seeing more and more, in workplaces? Have you been? Are you a chaplain yourself? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Steve, in the reading up I did on this before the show, a common theme seemed to be, this is not about conversion. The goal of a chaplain is not to convert anybody to their faith. That's an important part of this?
Absolutely. We are there to provide care for the employees. So we show up. We do life together. We refer them to people in the community that can help them. For those people that do have a spiritual question, if it's within our faith tradition, we're happy to go there. We're chaplains. But again, we're also more than willing to provide care, provide service to people, and get them the help that they need.
I wonder if some people think, well, why would I want a chaplain work? If I have a question related to my spiritual needs or the counseling I might need from a spiritual environment, why wouldn't I go to my own congregation, my own faith leader?
Very insightful question, actually, Rob. When you think about it, as a culture, the workplace, as conflicted as it is for many people, is their primary place of community. Mm-hmm. It's where they spend most of their time. You know, we as a culture are getting away from, I think, unfortunately, families as being the primary place of community, neighborhoods, or even houses of faith. It could be argued that social media is becoming the primary place of community, but I think the jury's still out as to longer term, whether that's a true form of community. You know, is it replacing real-time, you know, relationships? So the workplace, again, is becoming the primary place of community for many people. What better place than to provide care for employees? And I might add, you know, business leaders are deciding to implement a chaplain assistance program because they feel it's the right thing to do in terms of their leadership, their stewardship of those employees, but they're also doing it for business reasons. You can build a case that there's reduced turnover, employee turnover. You help employees with their personal stuff, and they will be better employees. And we've seen it they have much greater loyalty than to the company, which is good for business as well.
I'm going to bring in a couple more callers to weigh in on this. Cassandra is with us in La Crosse. Cassandra, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to add that I have a chaplain at my current employer, and to kind of piggyback off of what the previous caller just said about having the chaplain be most concerned about faith, I feel like our chaplain is there to talk about faith if we want, but also to talk about personal things in our life. And I just wanted to say that I really enjoy that because he's there for us. Our company has provided him for us. So our company is concerned about our feelings and not so much particularly in this case about how it affects business because they're paying for it.
Cassandra, thanks a lot for that call. I want to go straight to Chris with us now in Mayville. Chris, hi.
Yeah, hello. I wanted to call in. I've worked at a place, at a business with a chaplain before, and it was extremely helpful. And I think what was most helpful about it was that, you know, work can be a place where you're afraid to share your insecurities. It can be a place where when you mess up, you're afraid to let anybody know. And it can create a sense of isolation and sadness. And, you know, you don't feel like you can talk to the boss about it. And a chaplain can be the bridge to make that happen.
Interesting, Chris. Thanks. And thanks to Cassandra as well. So that's how this is supposed to work, Steve?
Absolutely. Thanks, Cassandra and Chris, for speaking about your experience with workplace chaplaincy. Yeah, there are, in any given time, any given community, there's stuff happening in people's lives. And some of it is a result of bad choices. Some of it is just a result of circumstances. And the key issue is whether or not people have access to help and access to resources. The reason why a chaplain program, I think, works so well is because if an employee is embarrassed by something, they may or may not want their employer to know about it. If they're into some kind of addiction, they know they need help, they'd like to get help, but they need their job. They're not going to go to the boss or go to HR and ask for help. Mm-hmm. Whereas a chaplain can. Keep in mind that all of our discussions are confidential. And so whatever an employee shares with a chaplain is not reported, even if it's illegal, is not reported to authorities or to owners and managers mm-hmm. and to supervisors.
We'll leave it there for now. Steve, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob and Veronica, for having me.
That's Steve Cook. He's owner and founding chaplain at Capital Chaplains based in Middleton. They provide chaplain services to companies in South Central Wisconsin.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, mass shooting incidents are often blamed on mental illness, but our guest researcher says there's not as big a link between mental health problems and violence as many people assume.
A Wisconsin guest shares her story of recovery from alcohol addiction and her efforts to help other people overcome addictions of their own.
And we'll look at the results from Super Tuesday and find out where the presidential campaign goes from here.
It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.